In Toni Tuulatimuuti's debut novel, Private Citizens, a group of four recent Stanford graduates are living in San Francisco. They're trying to navigate the worlds of tech, nonprofits, identity, and, of course, love. It's satire, and it's wince-worthy in its accuracy. KALW's Nina Gensler-Deb sat down with Tuulatimuuti to learn about how his own time in the Bay Area influenced the book and why he chose to make it a comedy.
I want to be careful to distinguish that this is fiction and it's not only informed by your own life or even mostly informed. But, you know, you did go to Stanford and you are Thai and you worked in the tech world. So I'd love to hear about, A, how this informed the book that you wrote and also what you tried to reserve for yourself.
There's one character that I think people are going to associate me with right off the bat, which is a character named Will. Will is a Thai-American web developer who is biographically very similar to me. He's from Massachusetts. He lived in Noe Valley, which I did. And it was because I was aware that on the basis of race alone, people were going to be identifying me with him. And so, you know, I think that a lot of people, especially mass media, television, movies, stuff like that, in order to try to do an end run around stereotypes, they try to just take everything and flip it 180 degrees and say, like, well, we're going to make this Asian guy, you know, 8 feet tall and a woman, like a lady killer or something, you know. And, you know, to me, there's just something really fake and demeaning about that. What I tried to do instead was something that writers like Juno Diaz and Philip Roth and Mary Gateskill have done before, which is try to preserve the stereotype, actually, and even exaggerate it to a sort of absurd degree. But also write the character deeply enough that it becomes clear that no matter how well somebody fits a stereotype, there's so much to them beyond that, that they can be identified as an individual, that the stereotypical aspects of them are actually the least important.
Will is obviously not the only character. There are four main characters, and all of them are in certain ways more extreme versions of different kinds of stereotypes or whatever.
Yeah.
But I felt like they all were marked by such self-loathing and just struggling with that. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about inhabiting all of those different characters who are very different in a number of ways, but all seem to be struggling with that at times comic and at times really, really sad, yeah, self-loathing.
And, yeah. I'm really glad you identified it as self-loathing because, you know, less charitable reviewers and workshoppers have read the book and said things like, why does the author think he's so much better than these characters, you know? I think early on I had a bigger problem with this when I didn't get the voice quite right. You hear these characters basically haranguing themselves constantly. But self-loathing is a really important part. You could actually say that it's a sort of common meeting ground between these four very different characters. And a lot of where that comes from is privilege, right? Privilege is something that you can't really opt out of. You don't really have a say in whether or not you have it or not, much like other sort of identity things like race. Why does it give rise to self-loathing? It's because when you are aware, painfully aware, that you have you are the beneficiary of these different kinds of privilege, and you still fail to achieve your goals, you know, it's easy to sort of turn this inward and say, I'm benefiting from an unfair system and I'm still f***ing up. And here, you know, I wanted to show how privilege can actually maim someone, you know, do them real physical and psychic harm.
I am speaking with Toni Tuulatimuuti about Private Citizens, which is a book that takes place here in San Francisco. But, oh God, it's 2016. I was about to say it's 7 years in the past, but it's not. It's
no.
9 years ago, which is crazy. And so I'm going to have you do the reading, if you would, that part. Yeah, tell us about it.
Okay, so here it's a section about the character Linda. Linda is this very young, precocious 21-year-old who's skipped a bunch of grades, and she's what we would identify as like a hipster, right? She's really severely judgmental, and she doesn't really have a fixed address. She's been getting by exploiting friends and guys that she's dating for places to stay. And she prides herself on this sort of identity that she's like forged, because she also believes in herself as a writer. The problem is that she doesn't really do any writing. So
So here she's showing up to a party, and the idea is that she's trying to look for someone new to stay with because she's kind of worn out her welcome at this other place. So she's wandering around a party right now. Linda took a pint bottle of Wild Turkey from the bar and nursed it in the hallway until two guys approached her. They looked identical, beards and knit caps and red plaid flannels. She really couldn't tell the difference between them. She missed the beginning of what one of them was saying. It's like strictly an aesthetic designation, like it's all image, so if you look it, you are it. So anyone who's all asymmetrical hair, big glasses, beard, hoodies, tattoos. Yeah, but that's just like a subset of what I'm talking about, said the other. They even sounded the same. There used to be like a cultural lineage behind it, starting with the beatniks, like Lenny Bruce. Yeah, and like Norman Mailer had that article about how quests for authenticity are perforce and authentic, and it used to be a subculture, but now it's kind of melted in this confederation of resuscitated subcultures, like post-punk, hardcore, new wave, 60s, counterculture, late 80s, emo, right? But it's also an economic designation, right? Like these young people with something to prove about money, so they're either rich and want to feel like they've succeeded without privilege, or poor and either want to reject or surpass economic value systems. And you know, both stances require alienation from the commercial mainstream, so they have to commit themselves to esoterica or faux, sincere, ironic appropriation of pop culture. Right, yeah, so like at the crossover tipping point, they would flee to other undergrounds, but now that the long tail makes everything effectively popular, those distinctions don't matter anymore, so it really is an economic designation. But then how do you explain all the like, the identifiable stereotypes, right? Like what are skinny jeans but the millennial beret? Or like the overgroomed beard, a perfect emblem of masculine ambivalence emerging from a progressive subculture rooted in regressive nostalgia and pride mingled with shame, not to mention sincere aestheticism performed through ironic mediums, who love good coffee but complain about what good coffee places do to their neighborhoods, and who will collect vinyl from the 90s but sneer at the bands they followed 3 years ago whose breakout success they themselves enabled, hold art openings in vintage clothes stores, music shows and car washes, bars and converted barber shops, and an again ironic expression of the sincere impulse to live the bohemian lifestyle while evoking the authentic vocational self-sufficiency of the parents who bankroll their freewheeling endeavors. Linda was stunned by the ecstatic tsunami of irritation massing and cresting inside her as she listened to this tedious, pukesome conversation. She glanced from idiot to idiot as if observing a ping-pong match between players who missed the table every time.
God, talk to me about writing that passage.
So the passage was originally two paragraphs long, and I was taking a workshop with Wells Tower at Iowa. And he never really writes on manuscripts.
Just to clarify quickly for people, you're speaking of the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop.
That's right, yeah. And he read this passage, and next to this passage, she wrote tedious and pukesome, which is a phrase that I ended up co-opting for the passage, right? But I don't know. My process is like 80% spite-driven, so when I... When I read this, I'm just like, oh, then I just need to make it 8 times longer. I need to put hyphens between every single word. And I need to exacerbate everything that I take to understand that he found objectionable about the passage. Stylistically and aesthetically and also on a plot level, I wanted to not shy away or make the subjects I'm writing about artificially demure. I really wanted to go like over the top with them. This book is a comedy, and the fact that it is a comedy is a liability in terms of the way that people approach it, because people have a lot of assumptions about comedies that they're basically less inherently important or interesting than drama. It's sort of, you know, the proverbial like redheaded stepchild of drama, right? But it's never that need of a division. There are very few books that are totally devoid of the very few comedies that are devoid of tragedy and vice versa, right? So I just see it as an artificial distinction. It's a cliche to say something is it's funny because it's true, but you know the salient point there is that things are really really funny because you recognize them to be true. But just in a way that you've never expected or a perspective you never considered before. And, you know, that to me is as good a criterion for literary fiction as any,